Let me explain where we are at the moment in this course. So we did a few hours, a few lectures, with a quick introduction to the essence of quantum field theory, in the fluctuations of fields. And we did that in different ways. We did it in by using operators, and we also did it in the Heisenberg picture, and then most recently we did this in the Schrödinger picture, in close analogy to how in first quantization we do the Schrödinger picture. So the aim of this was to give you a first taste of how quantum field theory works. Now, that chapter is closed, and we will systematically build up quantum field theory, first on flat space-time, and then on curved space-time, and then we will do the cosmological applications. So what we'll do today is return to the Heisenberg picture, because we will do almost everything in the Heisenberg picture in this course. And then today, we will study the concept of particles. Remember that in quantum field theory, we can do something that has absolutely no analog in first quantization. And that something is that we can now describe the creation and annihilation of particles. The first quantized Schrödinger equation had no way to do this. You could describe 5 electrons at once if you wanted to, but there was no way to describe the annihilation or the creation of new electrons, for example. So in quantum field theory, we can describe that, and today we will discuss how particles can be created and annihilated. How quantum field theory describes that. There are multiple mechanisms for this, and we will go through all of them. In particular, we will find out by the end of this class today how an antenna produces photons. How does an antenna work? You send current up and down a wire, and that creates electromagnetic fields. And those electromagnetic fields, because they decay, like the electric field decays, and then you have a magnetic field, and then that decays, and so on. And each electric field that decays creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field that decays creates an electric field. This is how you get traveling electromagnetic waves. But that's not how we're going to do it. That's the classical way. We are going to calculate how, when you have charges going up and down an antenna, or in fact, more generally, you have a time-dependent charge distribution. It doesn't have to be confined to an antenna. It could also be an aerial distribution that is time-dependent, or a volume distribution that's time-dependent. Then that, in some simplified view, will create classical electromagnetic waves. But we want to know, how does it create photons? Right? So we will find out today how, with a time-dependent charge and current distribution, you generate photons. Okay, so the first step is we return to the Heisenberg picture. Remember, the last thing we did was the Schrödinger equation, Schrödinger picture, in order to calculate quantum fluctuations. Now, back to quantum field theory in the Heisenberg picture, where the operators are time-dependent. And the state is frozen in time. And our mission now is to find out how quantum field theory allows us to describe particles and their creation and annihilation. So to start with, let's remember what the equations are, which are the equations that we need to solve. Well, we need to solve the hermeticity conditions, that the field is Hermitian, the canonically conjugate field is Hermitian, pi dagger is pi. We need to solve the canonical commutation relations. These are the non-trivial ones. But in addition to that, you remember, of course, that all the phi commute with another, and all the pi degrees of freedom operators commute with another. And we have the equations of motion. That's the Klein-Gordon equation. Here, this pi dot is, of course, phi double dot. So this is just the D'Alembert operator here, second time derivative minus the sum of the second space derivatives plus m squared phi equal to zero. That's just a Klein-Gordon equation, but written in the canonical form by introducing the pi for phi dot. And that's, in fact, the second equation of motion, namely that phi dot is equal to pi. So these are the three sets of equations that we need to solve. And once we can do this, we have solved the quantum field theory. For simplicity, let us assume we do this again with infrared regularization. So we assume we study physics in a box of size L, where to be safe, we may choose this L to be several billion light years across, so the box is huge. And we may impose, for example, periodic boundary conditions. I'm planning to soon post a description of the project for this course. And if you wish, you can do this project, the simulation of quantum fluctuations in flat and expanding spacetimes, with the periodic boundary conditions. But I recommend doing it with Dirichlet boundary conditions. And I will show you how to do this in the description of the project. So for now, let's choose periodic boundary conditions. Of course, none of the two are physical, right? The universe doesn't repeat itself after a billion light years. It doesn't really obey periodic boundary conditions. But it's also not true that the field decays to zero at the boundary. The boundary is just an imagined boundary. We're saying, let's assume we just are interested in a chunk of the universe that's very big. The benefit is that if we consider just a box of the universe, just a chunk of the universe, then we don't need the Fourier transform. We can do the Fourier series transform. This is the relationship again. We have a discrete set of momenta in this case, because it's the box, and only plane waves of particular wavelengths are periodic in a box. Therefore, the k values are discrete. And the x values are, of course, continuous, but confined to the box. This is the transformation between the Fourier coefficients and the fields. And that is true for these fields before and after quantization. Fourier transform works for operators the same way that it works for ordinary functions. And why that is, you can imagine to be for the following reason. These operator-valued functions can be viewed as matrix-valued functions. Yes, in general, they're going to be infinite by infinite matrices. But what you see here is matrix as a function of x and matrices as a function of k. And it's basically a Fourier transform or Fourier series transform for every one of the matrix elements. Now, you can write these operator-valued functions as matrices in many different bases. But it doesn't matter, because the Fourier transform is a linear map, the change of basis is a linear map, and these two things are therefore compatible. Okay, so we do the Fourier series expansion, and do you remember why that is good? It is good because now what used to be the Laplace operator, the sum of the second space derivative, simply becomes k squared. So our Klein-Gordon equation now becomes this equation, and there's no longer any k derivative in here. Canonical commutation relations take this form, and we have that for every k vector, remember that k is a three-component vector here, and these are the components, three integers, positive or negative, multiplied with 2 pi over L. The set of all these triples is the set of all these momentum vectors that can still occur. And the reason why we did this Fourier series transform was that we got rid of the second space derivatives that we had in the Klein-Gordon equation originally. Now that we have just the k squared term, we have that for every value of k, this is the differential equation of a harmonic oscillator that is not coupled to any other harmonic oscillator. So we have decoupled the system. The partial differential equation that we had originally, this one, this is a partial differential equation that has time derivatives and space derivatives, has become a bunch of uncoupled ordinary differential equations that have only time derivatives here. So we have independent harmonic oscillators here. At every point in momentum space k, but momentum space is now a discrete space, we have a harmonic oscillator sitting. The Hamiltonian of these harmonic oscillators is the sum of the Hamiltonians of the individual harmonic oscillators, and each individual harmonic oscillator has simply the usual form for the energy. Yeah, and so the total harmonic oscillator is just the sum over all these harmonic oscillators of the individual modes. Remember that every allowed momentum vector is called a mode. Now, what about particles? We have so far only talked about fields, field configurations, measuring of field configurations, visualizing them, getting pictures of fluctuations, and so on. But what about particles? Here's a crucial observation. For every wave vector, k, for every mode, we found that there's an independent harmonic oscillator, and the frequency of these harmonic oscillators was So for every k, we have a harmonic oscillator, and the frequency is the square root of this. Right? So that frequency we may call omega k, omega of k. So let's see where this leads us. We have that for every mode oscillator, we have identified its frequency. It is omega k. Now, harmonic oscillators have a discrete spectrum. And the discrete spectrum of a harmonic oscillator is, as always, given by h bar omega k, and then 1/2 or 3/2 or 5/2 and so on. It's the typical integer spacing of harmonic oscillators. So we are arriving now at a super crucial point. Is at the heart of quantum field theory. What we see is that at every point in momentum space, we have sitting a harmonic oscillator, and the harmonic oscillator for the momentum k has this spectrum. And we can ask, what is the energy difference between the ground state of that harmonic oscillator and the first excited state, the second excited state, the third excited state? Well, the energy difference is what? It is h bar omega k. Right? That's the energy difference between the ground state and the first excited state. And also between here and there, the difference is 2/2, is 1, so, right? It's h bar omega k. This means that the excitation levels of each of these harmonic oscillators for a mode differ by h bar omega k. Somehow, well, h bar became 1 at this point. So it's omega k, which is this. Now, if you have a particle with momentum k, so it's a three-component vector k vector. If you have a particle of mass m and momentum k vector, what's its energy? Remember? Imagine you have a particle of mass m. Then it will be true that k naught squared minus k vector squared equal to m squared, right? Setting c equal to 1. That's the mass shell for relativity. This is the energy here, right? So what we have is that the energy is equal to square root of k vector squared plus m squared, which is omega k. So what we see here is that when in a quantum field theory, one of those harmonic oscillators, let's say the harmonic oscillator for a momentum k, we pick a particular one, is excited to the first excited state, and all the other harmonic oscillators are still in the ground state, then the energy of our quantum field has gone up by omega k. By h bar omega k. If that harmonic oscillator is excited twice, well, the energy went up by 2 h bar omega k, which is the amount of energy that a particle costs of that momentum. So this suggests to interpret the excitation of a mode oscillator as the existence of a particle. So whenever we excite a mode oscillator, one higher level, it's like adding a particle to our theory. So, for example, if we had that the quantum field has all mode oscillators in their ground states, but one mode oscillator, let's say for mode k vector, whatever, three components, is excited to the fifth excited state, well, then we know that the quantum field carries 5 times the energy. Its energy has increased by 5 times the amount of energy that the particle of momentum k and mass m would have. So it's consistent to say, apparently I'm describing the existence of 5 particles of momentum k. And you see now that in quantum field theory we can describe not just the existence of 5 particles, we can also describe the existence of maybe 5 particles and maybe 3 particles. It would be the linear combination of a state where, you know, this harmonic oscillator is in the fifth excited state and it's in the third excited state. We can now do things that would have been unthinkable in first quantization. We can describe linear propositions of so many particles existing or so many particles existing. So let's see. This is the big hypothesis here, namely that the excitation of modes is particle creation. So if we start with the quantum field in its ground state, the state that we would call the vacuum for now, the no particle state, and then by one means or another, we can pick out one of these oscillators, not an oscillator in space, but an oscillator in momentum space. Pick one of those k's, and we shake it. We somehow excite it. Then that corresponds to the production of particles of that momentum. And you see, I guess, where we are going with this. As I told you, at the end of this lecture today, you will know how to calculate how an antenna produces photons. So you have a charge or a current distribution as a function of time, you can then calculate how many photons will be flying off in all directions. True, we aren't going to do it with electromagnetism, we're going to do it with a simplified version of the Klein-Gordon field, but it's the same story up to gauge fixing for electromagnetism as well. So what this will amount to is that these charges and currents, classical charges and currents, of course ultimately they are quantum, but with a very good approximation you can assume that the charges and currents in an antenna are classical. So what we are going to do is we are going to use charges and currents to drive, to excite the harmonic oscillators, or at least some of the harmonic oscillators in the quantum field. Which then means, well, they're excited now, which means we have particles there. Which means we have photons. So the creation of photons is mathematically the driving of the harmonic oscillators of the quantum field so that they get excited. All right, so that's the hypothesis, namely that mode excitation is particle creation. Now, does this interpretation work? I mean, it's just based on this coincidence, apparently, that the amount by which the energy of the quantum field goes up if one of these harmonic oscillators gets excited by one more is just the amount of energy that the particle costs of that momentum. Let's see. Now it turns out, let me first show you these two sentences, the interpretation works. Oh, what is it now? Restart now? No. Restart your computer now to finish installing important. All right. Okay, so one finds that this interpretation, this hypothesis works, but the trouble is it doesn't really work. It doesn't work fundamentally. That's when accelerations come in or when curvature comes in. Space-time is curved or expanding, or if your detection mechanism for particles is a machine that is accelerating. So acceleration, or as you can expect by the equivalence principle, gravity, can interfere with this. And you can have situations, as we will see in lecture 8, you can have situations where for one observer there are no particles and another observer will see particles. So the very notion of particles will be highly non-trivial in quantum field theory. However, as long as we don't have accelerated particle detectors, I mean, as long as we have particle detectors that are not accelerated, and as long as curvature doesn't play much of a role or space-time expansion plays no role, that interpretation is going to be fine. The interpretation of just excitation of mode oscillator means particle is existing, fine, it's going to be fine. And this is for Minkowski space and inertial detectors. It is the basis of particle physics. In particle physics, we use that interpretation all the time. But let me give you an indication for what we'll have to do in order to make our formalism work also when there is curvature, when space-time is expanding, or when our observers are accelerating. In that case, we have to retreat and say, well, all of this hypothesis building and philosophizing about quantum field theory is good and fine, but ultimately, whether or not we find a particle is a matter of whether a detector that tries to detect the particle will click or not. So what we will do is this. Consider again the picture of a water surface. We can find out if there's an excitation in there by putting a cork in there. In the case of a quantum field, we can put a little grain of material in there which is able to absorb, for example, photons. For example, an atom. We can put an atom into a quantum field, and then if a photon comes along, the atom can go from its ground state to its excited, to an excited state, which we can measure. And then that would tell us, oh, well, the photon, the atom didn't just on its own get excited, it must have absorbed a photon. So we will then say, okay, we detected a photon. We know that because the atom swallowed it. It used the energy to go from ground to the excited state. So if we retreat to what's experimentally measurable, then we are in safer territory. And we can say, okay, now that's our measurement instrument for the existence or absence of photons. And we can, for example, then also consider accelerated atoms or put our atoms into a space-time that's expanding or near to a black hole and so on. So this will be one of the tools to make sure we don't lose track of the particle picture, namely by boiling it down to concrete measurement procedures. So we won't simply say that the excitation of a Mode oscillator is the ultimate criteria for the existence of particles. No, that's too risky. But if we have some particles there that can serve as detectors of radiation, then we trust that interpretation, even though there's also quite a lot of non-trivial stuff going on with those. All right, so conventional particle physics, the kind that is probed by accelerators, that particle physics is based on the special case of no curvature, no acceleration of the detectors, where we can simply say excitation of Mode oscillators is creation of particles. So for today, let's play this through and see how this looks like. So for example, which would be the state psi of the quantum field in which we have three particles of one momentum, let's call it k index A, and seven particles of momentum k index B. So we should think of this as preparing the quantum field with 10 particles, three of them moving this way and seven of them moving that way. Okay, as plane waves, because with fixed momentum, right? So this we want to describe three particles traveling with this momentum and seven particles traveling with that momentum. We know the momentum for sure of these particles. That's the situation we want to describe. Now, how would we do this? We would say, well, the state of the quantum field is the state which is in terms of the harmonic oscillators in which we decompose the field. It is the state in which the Ka harmonic oscillator, the Ka mode, The harmonic oscillator for the K3 vector Ka is in its third excited state, in which the harmonic oscillator for the mode Kb is in its seventh excited state, and all the infinitely many other oscillators of all the infinitely many other modes are in their ground states, n k equal to zero. So we can write it like this. The harmonic oscillator for the Ka mode is in its third excited state, n k a equals 3, and then tensor product with the mode oscillator of the Kb mode being in its seventh excited state, and then the tensor product of the vacuum state, of the ground states, of all the other harmonic oscillators of all the other modes. Then we can calculate what's the energy of the total state of our quantum field theory now. Well, the energy of this state, when we apply just the Hamiltonian of one mode to it, remember the total Hamiltonian is the sum of the Hamiltonians of all the harmonic oscillators, right? So H hat K is the Hamiltonian of just the Kth harmonic oscillator. If we apply that to our state psi, then what we get depends on which Hamiltonian we choose. If we choose the Hamiltonian of the Kth harmonic oscillator and K is chosen to be equal to Ka, well then we find this state is an eigenstate to a H hat K with eigenvalue H bar omega K 1/2 plus 3, because it's in the third excited state at harmonic oscillator. Similarly for the Kb momentum. And then if we choose the Hamiltonian of a harmonic oscillator of momentum K, where K is neither Ka nor Kb, then the energy, then this state is found to be an eigenvector, well, ground state eigenvector, so its energy is H bar omega K half. Now, this H hat is the sum of all of these. When we apply that onto psi, we get all of these contributions added up, because it's the sum of these Hamiltonians. Psi is eigenvector to all of the H hat K, and the various prefactors that we get are written here. So what we find is that the total energy is given by all of this. Right? So psi is an eigenstate to the total Hamiltonian with this eigenvalue. It's three contributions from the three excitations of Ka, seven from the excitations of the Kb mode, and then we have all the ground state energies of all the modes. And you may notice that this is infinite here. Right? We get sum over all k vectors, of which are infinitely many, and then we have all these omega k's, and that sum is divergent. Those are fine contributions, but this is divergent. Now, do we need to worry about this here? Not really, right? Because as we saw with the mc squared term, when we looked at the Klein-Gordon equation and how it reduces to the Schrödinger equation, we found that the Klein-Gordon equation has a non-relativistic limit to the Schrödinger equation, but you get an extra term in the Hamiltonian, which is mc squared. But the mc squared is multiplied with the identity, just a number, right? So it just offsets the overall energy. But that makes no difference, because it's a constant in the Hamiltonian which commutes with all the observables, so it doesn't affect the evolution of the observables. And the same here, this thing is just an overall constant that comes up all the time. So therefore, we can just disregard it. Yes, it's infinite, but it doesn't change the equations of motion of the operators at all. Right, so this would be a state that describes three particles in this direction and seven particles in that direction, for sure, right? So that's what it would be. But we can also have linear combinations. So for example, we could have a state in which we have a probability amplitude for three particles going this way, and we have a probability amplitude for seven particles going that way. That's a different state now. You see, this state, where we have one oscillator in the third excited state, and all the other mode oscillators in the ground state, is a state in which we have for sure three particles moving in the direction Ka. And for sure, we don't have any particles moving in the direction Kb. This, however, is a state in which we have seven particles moving in the direction Kb and no particles doing anything else. But in quantum field theory, you can write down a linear combination of these two, where we have, well, there's a probability amplitude for three photons to travel that way, and a probability amplitude for seven photons instead to travel that way. In principle, this state can be created. Not just in principle, you can actually do this with photons. So this would be a state with non-fixed particle number. It's not clear how many particles you're going to find, because there's a certain probability amplitude for finding three and another probability amplitude for finding seven. You're for sure not finding 11 or 20 or 5. You will find three or seven if you count, but not any other number, because it's just either three or seven. Now it turns out that with photons you can do this, but there are other particle species with which you cannot, because there's a conservation of charge involved, and then correspondingly so-called superselection rules. For example, you can't produce a state in which you would have either three electrons this way or seven electrons that way, because the amount of charge involved in that system wouldn't even be fixed in this case. And it's not just charges, it's also lepton numbers and other numbers that can be conserved, and therefore there are superselection rules. So quantum field theory in principle allows this, to have linear combinations of states with different particle numbers, but not for all particle species. Okay, so now we know how to describe states with different numbers of particles, namely as states in which some mode oscillators are excited and some may not be excited. And in general, of course, we can have states where there is a complicated probability amplitude distribution of having so many particles going this way or that way. And you can combine this to get wave packets and so on. You know that if you have a spatial wave packet, you can decompose it into its Fourier components. And so you can write that down as well. There are fundamental limitations to this, but I will not go into this now. Now that we know how to write down a quantum field theoretical state in which particles are present, let us ask how these particles can get there. How is it that a quantum field can get excited? How can it get from the vacuum state to an excited state? Or the other way around, how can a quantum field lose particles? Now clearly, since we associate the creation of particles with the excitation of harmonic oscillators, the same question can be rephrased, namely into how can a harmonic oscillator get excited? By what means can a harmonic oscillator get excited? There are actually two completely different ways in which a harmonic oscillator can get excited. Does anybody know which are these two ways? Two completely different ways in which a harmonic oscillator can get excited. So let's say we have a pendulum. Then you have to imagine this in the cinema of the mind, right? Just imagine it. I have a pendulum here. Now, how can I excite this? Imagine it's oscillating a little bit, but I want it to have a bigger amplitude. But what I can do is I can rhythmically move the center point left and right. If I do that, the right phase at the right time, right, at the right frequency, then the amplitude is going to get bigger and bigger, right? So I'm in resonance and I'm making this amplitude bigger and bigger. There's got to be a quantum analog of that, and we will calculate it today. But there's another way in which a harmonic oscillator can get excited. So imagine now I'm holding again the string My pendulum is oscillating a little bit, but I want it to oscillate more than that. But I'm not allowed to move the point where the string emanates from. What can I do to excite this thing? What I can do is I can pull on the string and let go. So imagine I do this. If I pull on the string, so now the pendulum gets shorter. So its resonance frequency changes. It gets higher. And then I let go again. Now the resonance frequency gets lower. And it turns out that if I do this, if I pull and let go on this thing, again, rhythmically, at the right phase, the right frequency, which is twice the frequency of what used to be the resonance, if I do this, then too, the pendulum will oscillate more and more. In this case, I will not have excited it the usual way, but in a so-called parametric way. The original way, the first way that I showed you how to excite a harmonic oscillator was by external driving. Right? It's like applying a force to your harmonic oscillator. By changing where the center is, you're effectively applying a force to it. Because imagine it was just hanging down, now I move it, then it's up, so it will move down. Right? So it's like applying a force to it. That's external driving. But there's another way to excite harmonic oscillators, and it's parametric driving. It's called parametric driving because there's no external driving force then, but instead we are oscillating, we are driving the parameters of a harmonic oscillator. We are making the frequency of the harmonic oscillator time dependent. So you see, a harmonic oscillator can be excited by either writing a driving force term on the right-hand side of the differential equation, or that would be external driving, or we don't add a driving force, but instead we simply make the resonance frequency itself time-dependent. If we make it suitably time-dependent, we get parametric resonance. There are huge differences between external driving and parametric driving, between external resonance and parametric resonance. If, for example, a system is externally driven, the old-fashioned way, with an external driving force, which means you have a harmonic oscillator equation, and instead of just having the back driving force, you also have an extra driving force from the outside, J of t. In this case, what happens if your driving force is in resonance, if it is at the resonance frequency of your harmonic oscillator? The amplitude grows, but how does it scale with time? At what rate does the amplitude grow? At what rate does resonance suck up energy? Do you know? It's linear, linear in time. Right? So the amplitude grows linear in time. So if you are flying in a plane and you find that the motor is in resonance with some resonance frequency of the metal of the plane, then sometimes the whole plane shakes. You get that with propeller machines, not with the jet engines nowadays. But if you fly with a propeller, you can get that. And if this wasn't dampened, the amplitude of the oscillations would grow linearly and the plane would fly apart. Which is why, they're designed so that at operating frequency of the propellers, you are not in a resonance of a plane. Because otherwise, all that energy it would want to build up, and you have to dissipate it, and it would be terrible. So it builds up linearly. Now imagine you have instead a parametric driving, where, like the pendulum, you do this kind of thing. One big difference is that parametric driving doesn't work from zero. If you have a pendulum hanging just down like this, and you start driving it like that, you can make it have big amplitudes. But imagine a pendulum is just hanging down like this. It's at zero. And you pull and let go, pull and let go. Well, then it goes up and down. It's not going to oscillate. You can't amplify a non-existent oscillation parametrically. But if you start with a little bit of an oscillation, you can amplify it parametrically. In fact, exponentially fast. It's no longer linear. It's an exponential growth of the amplitude. Could be potentially much worse than the external driving because it's exponential. Now, that's the classical situation. Now imagine quantumly, quantum harmonic oscillator. If you drive it externally, yeah, things happen roughly, as we will see today, the same way as classically. But now, quantum parametric driving, you think quantumly you could excite a harmonic oscillator from its ground state or not? See, you can actually. Parametric driving allows you to excite a quantum harmonic oscillator even from its ground state. Because at its ground state, it's not just hanging down. It's actually having a bit of oscillations going on, at least the probability amplitude for finding it away from zero. There's probability amplitudes for momenta, for positions, and so on. So in fact, yes, parametric driving can excite even the ground state, which is probably the reason why we are here. Because in cosmology, the quantum fluctuations that seeded the initial structure in the universe were quantum fluctuations amplified parametrically from the vacuum state. Actually, as we will see, it's even a little more complicated. Because there is one more way in which you can very efficiently excite a harmonic oscillator. And that is if you start with a harmonic oscillator like this, and of course parametric driving would mean that you change its omega as a function of time, so its potential, the parabolic potential of a harmonic oscillator would go like this, right? So if you take a harmonic oscillator and you do this with it, then it will get excited. That's parametric driving. Right? If you do this with time-dependent omega, it's like pulling and letting go on the string of the pendulum. If you do this, you can get excited. But imagine you overdo it a little and you make the potential of the harmonic oscillator open up, so you get a flatter and flatter and flatter parabola until it's completely flat and it flips. Now it's a downward-pointing harmonic oscillator. Now you can imagine what happens now. Now, if you have a wave function sitting there, like an initial Gaussian, for example, it's going to flow down, right? It flows down, it rushes down the inverted harmonic oscillator. This is confining, but this is driving away the, it's driving apart the wave packets, it's flowing apart, right? So you can have that situation going on. Now, that would be catastrophic if it goes on too long, so in fact, what can happen is that then it flips back over again, and then you have a very much excited state, because the wave packet has flown apart a lot. That kind of mathematics we will encounter in cosmology. Okay, so these are the three cases. We have the harmonic oscillator as a pendulum here. External driving is moving it left and right over here. Mathematically, we add here a J of T term, external driving. But then we can also have parametric driving, where we are changing the length of the string in the pendulum. And this amounts to changing the resonance frequency. So the resonance frequency is a function of time, which we choose, because it's our driving. But we can also make this omega go imaginary, so that then omega squared goes negative, so that whole thing becomes positive, and therefore we get that the confining potential becomes a deconfining potential like that, temporarily. And that means that our pendulum is like pointing upwards, right? It's not on a string, but it's on a stick, and it's upwards. And then it really wants to fall down left or right. Now, of course, keep in mind that the pendulum is not a very good approximation, because it's harmonic only for small deviations, either from zero here or the top up there. Okay, so this is just to anticipate the kind of math that comes up. Now, all of these cases that we just discussed for how a harmonic oscillator can get excited do occur in nature. In particular, the first case, the external driving, is what's happening in particle accelerators. This is how particles get created in particle accelerators and annihilated. And the mathematics of this is schematically this one. Imagine we have two fields. Could be the field of electrons and the field, quantum field of photons. And we might schematically describe them as phi and psi. So the psi would be like for the electrons and the phi for the photons. Then the total Hamiltonian of the quantum field theory of both species would be the sum of the free Hamiltonian of just photons, that would be the quantization of the Maxwell equations, and the free Hamiltonian of the quantization of electrons, that would be the Dirac equation in second quantization, plus an interaction Hamiltonian, which will contain the photons and the electrons. In practice, of course, it's going to have a psi bar psi, because these are fermions. But schematically, it's a product of fields of different species. So we're going to have free Hamiltonian, and interaction Hamiltonian between them. Do we have a bird in here? Yes. Okay, so there are different interpretations of what goes on if we have two different species of fields in here. We have, in the wave picture, wave interpretation, we have simply quantum fields that have waves in them, and they are interacting with each other. So you can think of this as having a non-trivial interaction of waves of different types, different fields. So while, for example, photons just pass through each other, photons and electrons don't. Photons and electrons see each other, and that would be described by the presence of this interaction Hamiltonian here. Now, there's also a particle interpretation of this, which is that the collision of two particles happens when their mode oscillators drive each other. Right? So let's say you have a particle with this momentum and a particle of another species with another momentum, and they collide, and then more particles might be created. Mathematically, it's the interaction between the mode oscillators. So you have to Fourier transform the whole thing, and then you get an interaction between the mode oscillators of the psi field and the mode oscillation of the phi field in momentum space. You get momentum conservation in this automatically from translation invariance. And then you get that, you know, these harmonic oscillators drive each other. The psi field provides the J of the psi field provides the J for the phi field, and the phi provides effectively a J for the psi field. So the oscillators of the electron modes drive the oscillators of the photon modes, and vice versa. So these harmonic oscillators are coupled because of this product of the two fields. Here in position space, if you Fourier transform it, this becomes this type of terms, products of fields of different species, become terms that couple mode oscillators to each other so that they can drive each other. And then you find that the strongest effects occur when we have resonance there in this driving. And that's the reason why it takes high energy particles to create high energy particles. It's because otherwise they're not in resonance. You can't just take two low energy particles, collide them, and then expect high energy particles to come out of it. It's ultimately an issue of non-resonance, so this doesn't happen. Okay, so that's regular particle physics. That's external driving, where one species of particle acts as the external driving force for another species of particle. But then we said there's also external driving. There's also parametric driving of harmonic oscillators, and that can happen in the presence of gravity, because gravity can mess with the omega k of t. That's what it can do. Curvature can change the omega k of t, the expansion or shrinkage of space-time, or the presence of a black hole, the formation of a black hole. These things can change the omega k's, make them functions of time, and therefore create particles. For example, in the wave interpretation, if we just look at this from the perspective of fields, of waves in fields, what do we have? Well, we expect that the cosmic expansion, the expansion of space and time, stretches the wavelength of photons. Which means that the omega of t decreases, the frequency should decrease. So that should have an impact. And we will find that this is true. But then there's also this phenomenon where parametric driving is sort of perverted, where it's not just this going on, but it goes all the way and then like this. This happens too. But when would that happen? It turns out this happens in a very special circumstance. Imagine the space-time is expanding at a very high rate. Actually, the rate itself is not important. It's important that it's accelerating. So imagine that the universe is expanding at an accelerated rate. When that is true, then the space-time has what is called a horizon, which means the two observers can only communicate with each other if they're not too far away from each other. If they're too far away from each other, then they may try to communicate. They send each other a signal with their smartphones, for example. It travels at the speed of light. But because our observers are so far apart from each other, more space between them is generated at a higher rate than the signal can cross. Right? So if the two observers are so far apart from each other that per second more than 300,000 kilometers of space are being created in between them, then light cannot catch up. So, you know, the signal from A to B travels at the speed of light, but more space is being created in between them continually and at a rate that exceeds what the light can do, or what the microwaves from your smartphone can do, because, you know, that's how they communicate with microwaves. So there is a distance beyond which observers cannot communicate, because too much space is being created between them. Of course, if they're close enough, not much space is being created with between them at, I mean, not at a high rate, and so they can communicate. There is this horizon distance between two observers. So this is the phenomenon of horizon from the perspective of two observers, two travelers that want to communicate with each other using smartphones. That's the particle picture. Observer A is a particle, observer B is a particle. They are localized. Now let's look at the wave picture. Imagine you have waves in the universe. Thermal radiation, for example. Thermal radiation has all wavelengths, from very long wavelengths to very short wavelengths, with the probability distribution given by the Planck formula. Now, consider very short wavelengths, short compared to the horizon size. Let's say the horizon size is a light year, and now you have wavelengths of, I don't know, size 1 meter or 100 meters or something. How are they going to behave? As usual. Because the horizon is so big, the expansion is not so dramatic, everything is going to be fine as far as these waves are concerned. But what about waves whose wavelength is larger than the horizon size? That's a weird situation, right? Because a wave is something non-local. And now it's larger than the horizon size. And what we will find is that when waves have a size, a wavelength, larger than the horizon size, they stop oscillating. They stop oscillating, and that's nothing to do with quantum field theory. Even classical fields would do this. They stop oscillating, and the math behind it, in a subtle way that we will see, is this one, where it flips like this, temporarily. And it's going to be a crucial mechanism in cosmic inflation, and has to do with structure formation, and so on.
Is that supposed to say no particle creator when you say field application but no particle interpretation?
Ah, yes. So when the harmonic oscillator is inverted like this, then we can no longer speak of the existence of particles or even of the absence. The whole concept of particle loses meaning. Because remember this business? We said that if you have a harmonic oscillator, then the spacing between the excitation levels is exactly the amount of energy that the particle costs you. Right? Therefore, one more excitation, one more particle. But the harmonic oscillator that is inverted has a continuous spectrum. It doesn't have the discrete spectrum anymore because it's not confining. It has only scattering states. There is no such thing as a bound state in a potential that looks like this. Therefore, this whole picture falls apart. We can't even consider whether or not there are particles because the whole concept makes no sense anymore. Quantum fields still exist. It's still a quantum field theory. You can write down all the states and everything, but there is no sense in which you have particles. Not in this way, anyway. You can still place a detector there, like an atom, and see if it gets excited. That still survives. But the simple picture that the more excited the mode oscillator is, the more particles you have, that no longer survives. Yeah, thanks for pointing out that I wanted to say that here. Okay. So, much of this course is going to be concerned with the parametric driving due to acceleration and due to curvature. But we should also do the external driving. It's the simpler case. It is super important for particle physics, so let's do that. In this way, we will also see some of the math already appearing that we will later need for the parametric driving too. So let us consider the case A of how to excite harmonic oscillators, namely by external driving. So this would be particle creation through external driving of mode oscillators. And where this is aiming is what I promised at the beginning of the class today. I want to find out how to calculate the emission of photons from a charge and current distribution that's time dependent. Right? So this is external driving, because the charge and current distribution that we impose, for example, in an antenna, or by whatever other means, this time-dependent charge and current distribution is some classical driving force which will excite our quantum mode oscillators of the photons, and therefore create photons. And at this point, we will not yet have to worry about the particle interpretation, because this is going to be Minkowski space, and flat space, and no accelerations, and so on. All right, so let's consider the example of the production of photons by an antenna. We model here the electromagnetic field as a Klein-Gordon field, because the essence of it is already explained there, and once you get that, the electromagnetic field case won't be difficult. So what we are neglecting here is the fact that electromagnetic fields have polarization, whereas Klein-Gordon fields do not, and also that the electromagnetic field describes photons which are massless, but our Klein-Gordon field may or may not be massless. So now let us consider an arbitrary mode of our field. Think of it as the electromagnetic field. In practice, it could simply be one of the polarizations of the electromagnetic field. It will boil down to this. So we have our Klein-Gordon field, phi hat k of t. There's one point in momentum space, and phi hat of k. So if this harmonic oscillator, if this thing has the dynamics of a harmonic oscillator, if it were in the fifth excited state, it would mean we have 5 photons of momentum k. Now, we model the electric current as a given classical field. Of course, the electric current, like everything else in the universe, is quantum, but usually in electronics, for example, it's a good approximation to say that it's a classical current. So let us say we look at the classical current, describe it by a function j of x and t. J of x and t is the current as a function of space and time. And if we Fourier transform it with respect to the x variable, we get jk of t. So this is just the Fourier transform of our antenna action, of the time dependence of the charges and the current. Now, in a rough simplification, the electromagnetic mode k therefore obeys this equation. So if we take one mode oscillator of the electromagnetic field, then it is the usual harmonic oscillator, 1/2 p squared plus 1/2 omega k phi squared plus the term with the driving force. It's a phi times j. Right? If you calculate the equation of motion for this Hamiltonian, you will find that this phi goes away and you just have the j on the right-hand side. You know, because you have to do the commutator of h with pi, that's phi dot. Right? And so you get phi dot is the usual harmonic oscillator contribution, but then also the commutator of pi with this. You get the phi goes away because of the commutator with the pi, and you get, just get the j. So this Hamiltonian is the Hamiltonian for an external driving force j. So the mode oscillator of a photon for momentum k is driven by the k Fourier component of the charges and currents. Of course, this is going to be a vector ultimately, and for electromagnetic field, this is also going to be a vector, but you know, we get the essence of it also in the scalar case. So therefore, if the current J of t varies in time, if it really has a time dependence, then it can excite the mode oscillators. And it's the frequency or the wavelength k, or the wave vector k current components, which can excite the wave vector k photon components. So it's the same calculation for every mode oscillator. Every mode oscillator is a quantum harmonic oscillator for the quantum field, which is driven in our simplification here by a classical driving force, jk of t, which is the Fourier transform of the charge and current distribution as a function of time. Same calculation for every mode k. So we might as well just do this once and for all at the same time. We drop the k and we just say, well, it's any one of the k's. It's always this equation, this form of equation that we have to solve. The Hamiltonian is 1 half p squared plus omega squared q squared minus j q hat. Okay? So the p is really, of course, one of the pi k's. The q is really one of the phi k's. But the point is, we have to study the quantum mechanics of this and just apply it many times to this here. So let's do this. Let us calculate the dynamics of a quantum harmonic oscillator that's driven by an external classical force. That, once we can do this, we can then calculate the emission of photons from a time-dependent charge and current distribution, simply by substituting it back in. Okay, so we actually solve now a quantum dynamics here. First of all, let me remind you of the Schrödinger and Heisenberg pictures. First, without choosing a picture, in quantum theory, and by that I mean, remember, quantum mechanics is non-relativistic. Quantum theory is any quantum theory. So in quantum theory, first or second or whatever number quantization, in any quantum theory, we have that the predicted expectation value of an observable f bar, so if the bar means expectation value, right? The expectation value at the point in time t is always given by state of the system, observable f, and then the time evolution operator here, where the state is the initial state and the observable is the observable at initial time. And then if you put the time evolution operator here, this is what the expectation value for observable is later on. The time evolution operator obeys the Schrödinger equation, I d by dt, u equal to uh, where h is the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, which is the original Hamiltonian that comes from the quantization, where you just put the hats on the x and the p. And the time evolution operator has to obey the condition that at time t equals zero, it has to be the identity operator. Because at time t equals zero, we haven't evolved anywhere yet, so it's just initial state, the initial situation. Now, how do we get the Schrödinger picture? Let me quickly remind you of that. Schrödinger picture is obtained by taking that generally and picture independently, description of the time evolution of expectation values and by bracketing this way. Writing down exactly the same thing again, but bracketing this way. So that the time evolution is now in this newly defined time-dependent vector here. So u hat of t times gamma naught is now the time-dependent Schrödinger vector. And here the time-dependent Schrödinger vector again, and the observables are frozen in time. You know that, of course. So we have that the expectation value as a function of time is given by the time-dependent state used to calculate the expectation value of the frozen in time observable. Okay, that's the Schrödinger picture. And the dynamics in the Schrödinger picture is given by, as one can easily verify, it's given by I d by dt, gamma of t equal to Schrödinger Hamiltonian, and then Schrödinger state. By the way, Schrödinger Hamiltonian is not the same as the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. They're only the same if both of them are not time dependent. If there's a time dependence, you have to be careful there. Because the Heisenberg Hamiltonian will have time dependent operators in it. So the Schrödinger Hamiltonian is given by time evolution operator, Heisenberg Hamiltonian, inverse of time evolution operator. Of course, if the Hamiltonian is not time dependent, then it commutes with the time evolution operator, and therefore that just contracts, and we have the Schrödinger Hamiltonian is the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. Now, completely equivalently, we can work in the Heisenberg picture. Just to quickly remind you, we take the original formula that's true picture independently, and now we bracket this way. So now the observables are time dependent, and the states are frozen in time. So the expectation value is calculated by taking the initial state, which is frozen, and then calculating the expectation value of an observable, which is time dependent. Which is the more natural way to do it from the perspective of classical theory, because there it's the x and the p's that are time evolving, and in the Heisenberg picture too, it's the x and the p's that are time evolving. The dynamics now is that the observables obey this differential equation, I dt of f hat is the commutator of f hat with the Hamiltonian. Okay, crucial aspects of the Heisenberg picture. The state of the quantum system stays the same Hilbert space vector for all times. So for example, if at the beginning of the time evolution, when we prepare the system, the state is gamma, some Hilbert space vector, then it stays that Hilbert space vector no matter what happens until we measure, upon which then the state can of course collapse into the new state that comes out of the measurement. Now, in the Heisenberg picture, the observables, like the Hamiltonian and observer and arbitrary other observables, are time-dependent operators in Hilbert space. Now, an important implication of this is that the eigenbases and eigenvalues of observables, such as the Hamiltonian and observables, can depend on time. So, for example, we might have an observable f hat, which is a function of time, and then its eigenvectors may be functions of time too. The eigenvalues can only depend on time if the definition of the observable has an explicit time dependence in it, but the states can always be time dependent. You can think of this as, well, a matrix is evolving, so it's changing. The matrix is changing, and so the eigenbasis of it is changing as well. And in particular, that's true for the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian will have an eigenspectrum, it will have eigenvalues and eigenvectors, which generally depend on time. It's going to be super important, because if the system starts in a state gamma, and then the Hamiltonian evolves into another operator, then let's say gamma was the ground state of the Hamiltonian initially, but then the Hamiltonian changes. And so that state is no longer the ground state of the Hamiltonian later, which means particle creation has happened. So when we are looking for particle creation in the Heisenberg picture, we should not look, oh, what did the state do? Did it go from the vacuum state to an excited state? Not really, it cannot, because it's the Heisenberg picture. The state cannot change in time. No, in this case, it's the operators, the observables, such as the Hamiltonian, that change. So the state is frozen, but it may no longer be the ground state of the Hamiltonian. Not because the state changed. It's now because the operator changed, the Hamiltonian changed. It's nothing very special. It's just going from the Schrödinger to the Heisenberg picture, but it takes a little bit of wrapping one's mind around it. So for example, assume the driven harmonic oscillator starts out at time t1 in the nth energy eigenstate. So let's say gamma is the nth energy eigenstate at time t1. But now we have, okay, this means that the Hamiltonian acting on the nth energy eigenstate at time t1 is an nth energy eigenvalue times nth energy eigenstate. All of this at time t1. Now the state vector of the system, because we are in the Heisenberg picture, stays gamma even as everything evolves, because the state vector is frozen. But at later times, t larger t1, the Hamiltonian and its eigenvectors and eigenvalues may be different. In general, then, we have the Hamiltonian at time t has this eigenvector-eigenvalue equation. And these em of t might be completely different vectors from those en of t1. So we generally have that en of t is not equal to en of t1. And that means that, neither the eigenvalues nor the eigenvectors might match. And that means what used to be the energy eigenstate will no longer be the energy eigenstate later on. And we may have particle creation or particle annihilation. So what we can do then is we can calculate what we have. So at time t2, the system is still in the state gamma because we are working in the Heisenberg picture. And we still have that gamma is the nth eigenstate at t1, of course. That's just nth eigenstate at t1. But gamma is generally no longer in the nth or any other energy eigenstate later on. And so we can then calculate the overlap. We can calculate, for example, the overlap between gamma and the ground state at time t0, at time t, or the first excited state, second excited state. All those overlaps we can calculate, so the bracket product of the two, and we get the probability amplitudes, therefore, that the nth eigenstate evolved into the ground state, first excited, second excited, etc. So in particular, let's say the system starts out at the initial time t1 in the lowest energy state, which in the case of a quantum field theory would be the vacuum state. So we have the state gamma of our system, the frozen state gamma is the ground state at time t1. Now, if the ground state is not equal to the ground state at time t2, well, then that means that the state in which the system is no longer the vacuum state. So we must have had excitation. What I'm saying is that it's the same business as in the Schrödinger picture, but we just have to be careful because it's no longer the state that changes, but it's the operator that changes. So, strategy for solving the harmonic oscillator. We actually want to solve this, and we can actually do this. The harmonic oscillator, the quantum harmonic oscillator driven by a classical driving force can be completely solved. That's what we will do now. And that's all you need to know to calculate for any given charge distribution that you may have in mind, or current distribution that you have in mind, what the photons are that are going to be produced by this kind of antenna. So here's the problem. We have to solve the canonical commutation relations for our harmonic oscillator. Remember, we're just writing it down in first quantized language again, but we're really dealing here with a phi hat and a pi hat of index k, right? So, let us solve once and for all the driven harmonic oscillator, and then we can apply that to each one of the modes of the quantum field. So we have to solve the canonical commutation relations, the Hermiticity conditions, the Hamiltonian, has this form now with this driving force term in it, and the Heisenberg equations are given in this way. So we have the two equations of motion, Q dot is P, and P dot is minus omega squared Q plus the driving term, where this is a classical function of time. It's just a number valued function of time, and strictly speaking, there's an identity operator here because this has to act on the Hilbert space, and for that you need an identity operator here. Now, a very convenient trick for solving the quantum harmonic oscillator will now be introduced. Now, I know, of course, you've seen a Dagger operators before, and you may think, oh, I've seen them, I don't need to see that again. This you need to see now, because now you see why and how they have to be defined in exactly the way we do, because there's freedom in that, and I'll show you exactly what the freedom is and how to fix it. Super important. So first of all, why do we want to work with these A operators? Remember, it's not because particle creation annihilation. Ultimately, the Einer-Dagger operators, only in special instances do they actually create and annihilate particles. If you know coherent states, you know that if A applied to coherent is applied to a coherent state is the coherent state again, the A doesn't annihilate any particles if you apply it to a coherent state. So don't think of the Einer-Daggers as creation and annihilation operators just yet. Only in special cases will that make sense. Let me show you why we really introduce those Einer-Dagger operators. It's simply a convenient way to solve two things at the same time. You see, we need to know that we need to find out the dynamics of Q hat, and we need to find out the dynamics of P hat. Both of them would classically be real numbers. Quantum mechanically, they're self-adjoint operators. Now, in order to solve the dynamics of both of them at once, we can do a trick. We write down a linear combination of q hat and p hat with an I in front of the p hat. In this way, we get a new observable, if you like. We get a new operator, which is some real number times q hat plus I times some real number times p hat. If we can find out the dynamics of A of t, then we trivially have the dynamics of Q and of P2. We can simply solve for the dynamics of both of them at the same time. I'll show you in a moment how we do that. Assume you know A, then of course you also know A dagger. You just take, put a minus sign here, right? And if you know A and A dagger, then just suitable linear combinations will give you Q and P. So in other words, we've reduced the problem of solving for two real variables to the problem of solving for one complex variable. Except that this is not real, it's self-adjoint, and this is then, you know, a sum of a self-adjoint and anti-self-adjoint operator. So it's just a neat little trick that instead of solving for Q hat and P hat individually, we can solve for A, which is some linear combination of Q and P, with some real number and some imaginary number here. And we will choose these alpha and beta cleverly. There is choice in this, and we will make the right choice here. But it's very subtle what the right choice is. First of all, of course, we could choose our alphas and betas any way we want. We could choose this to be a million and this to be minus 5. Why not? We could do it, right? But there will be much better choices than that. So let's determine what the best choice for alpha and beta is. First, as I promised you, whatever we choose for alpha and beta, if we find out what the A of t is, after having made our choice for alpha and beta, if we find out what that is, then we get, of course, immediately also A dagger. It's the same thing as the A, but with a minus here. And then a little algebra shows that we can express the Q hat and the P hat in terms of the A and A dagger in this way. Easy. Right? The Q is just this self-adjoint part, and the P is simply the anti-self-adjoint part of A. Okay, so far, independently of what we choose for alpha and beta, if we can find the dynamics of A, we have the dynamics of Q and the dynamics of P. Now, we have therefore compactified our representation. Everything is now expressed in terms of A. We don't need to talk of Q and P separately anymore. And that means we should be able to express everything in terms of A, the canonical commutation relations, the hermeticity condition, the equations of motion. All of this is now expressible in terms of A, in just terms of one variable. Our hermeticity condition is trivial, we just used it here. But then we also have the canonical commutation relations. Now it turns out that if you write down the commutator between Q hat and P hat, then it becomes a commutator between A and A dagger. And what is it? Well, it's this. It's A of T commutated with A dagger of T is equal to 2 alpha beta. Easy. Just plug it in there and you will find that's what it is. So we haven't chosen alpha and beta yet. And so the commutator between A and A dagger is going to be 2 alpha beta. Now, we have complete freedom in choosing alpha, complete freedom in choosing beta. Let's choose them suitably so that this simplifies a little. Make sure that this is 1 over there. So we choose our beta to be 1 over 2 alpha. In this way, the commutator between A and A dagger is 1. Nice. Because we've seen before how we can deal with these things. Okay, so one choice is gone. We had 2 shots, right? One we just fired. We fixed our beta to be 1 over 2 alpha. No matter what we choose for alpha, that's completely free still, but the beta is going to be this, just to make sure that the commutator is easy. Good, so now we have this. Fine. Now, let's do the much harder job of expressing our Hamiltonian and therefore the equations of motion in terms of A rather than in terms of Q and P. So if we substitute everything back in here, remember this is P squared and then this is the Q squared. If you plug all of this in here, we find that the Hamiltonian takes this form. That looks a little bit complicated. And in particular, it's going to have a dagger squared terms in here, and a squared terms here and there, and then it's going to have mixed terms with a daggers and a's from the mixed terms in here, right? However, if you look at this closely, you find that the a dagger squared term comes with a prefect of minus 1 half alpha squared, and here the a dagger term comes with a prefect of omega squared half 1 over 4 alpha squared. If we choose this to be true, namely that this term is the negative of that term, well then the a dagger squared terms go away. And because the whole thing is Hermitian, also the a squared terms must go away, as you can verify also directly. So if we make that particular choice, well then yes, then the a dagger squared terms go away and the a squared terms go away. What is that choice? Well, let's see. This is the fourth power of alpha, right? So we multiply this equation by alpha squared, so we get the alpha to the fourth. We put a minus 1 half over there, and then we take the fourth root of the whole thing, and then we get in this way the fourth root of this, which is square root of omega half. So if we choose our alpha to be this, and therefore the beta, by what we fixed before, to be that, then we have that the A of t is this, right? Because that's the alpha here, and this is the beta. And the a dagger squared terms go away. And the a squared terms go away, and we're only left with the mixed terms. The Hamiltonian therefore simplifies to become simply omega, I mean it's h bar omega really, and then a dagger a plus 1 half minus j of t, and that's all unchanged. Okay, so you see what we've done. We've introduced 2 variables, alpha, beta, and we chose them so as to make sure that the commutation relations are fine and to make sure that the Hamiltonian is not unnecessarily complicated. And that fixed our choice of alpha and beta. So now the Hamiltonian is pretty simple, the commutation relations are simple. All we have to do now is solve the dynamics of A of t. Okay, so the Heisenberg equation of motion for anything is I f hat dot is equal to commutator of f hat with h. In the case of A, in the case of our A operator, we have that I A dot, I mean we choose the A for the f hat, is equal to, and then we have the commutator of our A with this Hamiltonian, which is easy to work out. We're going to get the term from this. And we're going to get a term from that. So we get that the IA dot is equal to omega A minus this. Now, if there was no driving force, we could immediately write down what the solution is. Right? Because if there was no driving force, it's simply saying that the time derivative is equal to omega times A, which means that A is A naught, the initial A, multiplied with a phase, e to the power I omega t. But we have that extra stuff in here. And amazingly, we can write down immediately what the complete solution of that is. Namely, the A of t is the initial A from the initial condition at time t equals 0 times e to the power I omega t. That's all we would have if there was no J. Plus, because there is a J, we get identity operator times this function of t, where we have an integral. See, it's a function of t because there's a t in here, which is in fact simply e I omega t, e to the power minus I omega t, the same factor as this one, right? I just put it here. I could also pull that factor out of it. So this thing is a function of t because of that, but it's also having a t dependence in this. And then t prime is a dummy variable that we integrate over. This is kind of the antenna equation. Because it tells you the dynamics of your quantum system, like your mode of the photon field, as a function of your mode of the Fourier component of your charge and current distribution. And what is this? Look at it. This is a function of t prime, and this is the Fourier factor for t prime. So what this is really A of t is equal to 1 times the Fourier transform of the driving force. But not the Fourier transform over all time. A full Fourier transform would require from minus infinity to plus infinity. No, it's only from the initial time t0 when the experiment started up until the time t that we're interested in. Okay. So let's look at the case of a force of finite duration. An antenna that operates only for a finite amount of time. A charge distribution that you shake for a while and then you let go. So our J of t is zero from the infinite past up until time t zero when the experiment begins. Then you have charge and currents doing wild stuff, expressed by J of t, which is really the Fourier component of some Fourier component of your charge and current distribution. So this driving force, this classical driving force because of the charges and currents, is doing something. And then at time t equal to capital T, we leave it alone. We remove the charges and currents and we stop the driving. And then from that point of time until plus infinity, until future infinity, we are not doing any driving. So it's a temporarily acting antenna here. In this case, what do we get? Well, let's look at this equation again. In this case, we can actually integrate from zero all the way to infinity by just integrating from zero to capital T. Because after capital T, the J is vanishing, right? So let's do this. And what we find is that if we define the integral from zero to capital T to be J naught, it's just a number after all. If we call this J naught, then the solution A of T is given by the following. At times before the experiment begins, t equals zero, before we start shaking the charges and the currents, this integral hasn't even started yet. So the solution is simply this, right? It's simply this is this. Then after capital T, when the force has stopped acting, this is the full integral from zero to capital T, and that's some complex number multiplied with the e minus I omega t, because there's e minus I omega t times this complex number that's integral. And for times, if we are interested in times during the driving, well, then we have to use this formula. But it's easy to give the answer before the driving starts, and it's easy to give the answer after the driving ends. Namely, here it is. For t before the driving starts, it's simply this, the solution. For t during the driving, the solution is the formula that we had above. For t after the driving ends, the solution is a in plus j naught, that complex number that comes from that integral times this factor here. And what is this? This j naught is the Fourier coefficient of your driving force at what frequency? Let's check. This is a Fourier transform, right? We established we're Fourier transforming the driving force, and we're evaluating the Fourier transform at omega. Omega being the resonance frequency of our mode. So what this is telling us is that if the driving is resonant with the mode of the photons that we are considering, then we have a good chance of exciting that. Otherwise, we are not. But also, remember that this is not truly a full Fourier transform. Imagine this is a plane wave, but not at exactly the right frequency. Then, because this is not an integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, the overlap between this plane wave and that plane wave is not going to be a direct delta, it's going to be a sinc function. Which means we're going to have excitation anyway. That's the time frequency uncertainty principle here. You get resonance, even off resonance a little bit, if you drive very briefly. Time frequency uncertainty principle comes in right here. All right, so now next what we will do is implications of all of this in terms of particle and photon production. So we will transform all of these things back and study exactly how many particles were created. So if you have these charge and current distributions running for this amount of time, then how many of which kinds of particles do we get? And once we've completed that, then we do the parametric case. We do it for flat space, and then for curved space time, for cosmology, and all those things. Okay, so now happy calculating of photon production from antennas. Okay, see you on Friday then.